Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Welcome to the GoTo Book Club. I'm here with my co-author, Matt Housley. We're going to talk about fundamentals of data engineering.
What's up? And I am the other co-author of Fundamentals of Data Engineering. It's great to be here.
What's up, Matt?
What's up? Happy Wednesday in this case.
Happy We're used to saying happy Monday on a podcast.
I know. It's been a while.
Yeah. What you been up to?
There's the one podcast that you've probably seen with Tony Bear, which is more like, it's a bit more shifted toward industry news than the Monday morning data chat that we used to do, but kind of some overlap there. And yeah, various consulting and things at the moment. How about yourself? I believe the book is coming along, right?
It's coming along well. It was just editing, old chapters and stuff and writing a new one. So yeah, it's coming along really well. So it's just nice. It's fun when you get to do it all on your own now. But it should be good. But you know, we're actually celebrating the third year anniversary of this tome. Exactly. This happens to be the India subcontinent translation here, but it's the one I have the most available.
I've got so many piles around of different translations now, right? It's getting to be ridiculous. It's like, what am I doing here?
Let's talk about that. I mean, you know, I don't think every book gets translated. And so, taking a step back, four plus years ago, we decided to do something really dumb called writing a book.
I know. It was.
Why did we do that?
So there was a discussion before the show started about war stories. And I think part of it probably came from the war stories perspective and also just kind of being in the industries. A lot of things were changing, right? I think we both came out of the Hadoop era. Everything had to be big data. Everything was MapReduce. Everything was very complicated. And then we sort of evolved into this new cloud era where you had a lot of tools that simplified things, but it was also very easy to build a lot of haphazard junk if you weren't careful. And I think that was one of our big motivations, right? Like, okay, in a world where a lot of the tooling is taken care of for you, what should you be focusing on? Like, what is your job as a data engineer? And I think that was kind of the baseline for us. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I think we saw a lot of things in our consultancy. So for the audience, we ran a data engineering consultancy for years called Ternary Data, which apparently still has a really good reputation in the industry.
Which is hilarious given that we're...
Yeah. It doesn't even exist anymore.
That's right.
So I think, definitely seeing, you know, a lot of the issues with, quote, modern data stack, as well as, you know, legacy data stack and big data data stacks and so forth, right? But it was... To take a step back, the practice of data engineering hadn't really been clearly defined either.
Right.
If you were to do a web search on what is data engineering, and we call this out in the book, you come up with a bunch of usually really bad articles, I think. And that was also irritating us, where it was like, data engineering is the use of Hadoop and Pig and Spark. And
yes.
It's not. So it was very tool centric.
And it was very vendor driven, right? Like you would find a lot of very SEO driven links to like Snowflake and such. So Snowflake's a great product. BigQuery's a great product, but data engineering is more than any single vendor product.
Right. You know, if we wanted to continue with our consultancy, we probably wouldn't have written the book, because we listed out all the ways you could think about data engineering and probably not have as many problems and bring people like us in to help you with your problems, right? But taking a holistic view of data engineering, I think that was, at least for me, one of the goals. I think for you is just there's a lot of chaos out there. I mean, there still is, right? I don't think it ever goes away. So.
Well, and part of the problem is that, and I was the one who coined the notion of the curse of familiarity, and that is that the new generation tools make everything look so easy that it's also very easy to make mistakes if you don't understand how things work behind the scenes. And so, like, how much of our consultancy was just dealing with companies that were using the wrong storage system for the type of data they were dealing with, right? So, like, using transactional databases for data that was much too large and more batch oriented to manage that. It was just, you would run into bottlenecks that way, or trying to do transactional work on column oriented databases like
Snowflake. Right.
We saw these things again and again and again. And so some of it was basics. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, your course familiar also came from some experience working with, you know, big data engineers.
Yes. Yep.
You know, and I think you mentioned that as in the context of also seeing people try and apply those on-prem legacy practices to the cloud.
Yep.
Right. So I think that was another aspect of where that insight came from. It was a very good insight because it manifests itself on a daily basis around the world still to this day. And I think it always will. So.
Yeah. Yeah. You give people any new thing and they're going to try to treat it like an old thing that's familiar, right? And It's nice to make tools that are familiar and easy to use, but you still need some background understanding and knowledge to actually use them correctly. And I think we're seeing a new version of this now where we have these Gen AI tools that will explain everything to you, but aren't giving you like the underlying background that you need to really do your job well. We're starting to see data leaks.
Yeah. They provide links to other AI generated articles.
That's right. Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's great. So, but we wrote this book pre ChatGPT, which is kind of interesting because it's almost a claim to fame now. It's like, yeah, we did it the hard way before AI, you know, because I think now it's, yeah, I think there's a suspicion that a lot of books are cranked out maybe a bit too easily. But no, we did it the hard, rugged, pioneer way of actually writing a book by hand with our brains, you know, maybe with spell check, a bit of Grammarly thrown in.
Grammarly, but before Grammarly was like a full-on LLM-driven tool, right? It was just like basic grammar checking and style and such.
Yeah.
In your document.
Yeah. I actually like the old Grammarly better. It sounds weird because now it basically sort of shoehorns your writing into, you know, it's kind of a bland way of writing. So,
yeah. And in general, okay. So to what degree, I think this is related to the book. I'm not trying to go too far off piste here because I think it's related to a lot of the tooling we wrote about, but to what degree are we seeing degradation of tools due to insertion of AI assistance? I can give you a very specific example. And again, I'm kind of calling
tell me more
out here a bit. But like, okay, so Databricks, great platform. And again, I recommended it to a client recently, right? But the AI assistant is terrible. It cannot write SQL at all. And it tries again and again and again. It gets it wrong every time. It's a disaster. And I'm like, what happened to the old school just like syntax parsers that would tell you the next keyword that you could use in a SQL query? And that's disappointing, right? It's like tools are easier for data engineers, but I think there are some real bear traps for new generation data engineers that they have to watch out for that could really derail their careers. And
well, how would they even know what to look for?
That's just it. Yeah. If you haven't spent time writing SQL by hand, then how are you going to know when it's feeding you bad information? How are you going to know when you're going off course, basically?
And I think that's the biggest difference. You know, I was thinking about what you know, people always ask, like, what would you change? What are the biggest differences, you know, when the book was launched versus today? And it's unequivocally and undeniably AI. I mean, that happened a few months after the book dropped. But I'm glad it did because I don't know that we would have finished it.
Yeah,
I was starting on a new book, right? I was starting on a new book and I saw AI and I was like, okay, crap. I'm just going to take like probably 6 months to a year off and just like see what happens, because
it's kind of crazy that we landed like right that year when ChatGPT blew up, right? Like 2022, right? It was the end of that year that like that launched and everything changed very quickly.
So. It did, but I don't even think OpenAI, I mean, I was talking to a friend and her boyfriend was on the team that created ChatGPT. It was just funny because I don't think they thought that was going to be a success. It was just a science project.
Right. So right.
Just never know.
Yeah. Have you read any of the books about Sam Altman, for example, Empire of AI or The Optimist, these two books that came out a couple months ago?
I read Supremacy. I have not read the other two.
Oh, I'll have to check that one out. Yeah. I'm still reading Empire of AI, but The Optimist was quite good as well. And they talk about that very thing that you're talking about. Like they were coming out with these new generation models that they thought were going to have a big impact, but ChatGPT was kind of this, you know, side project to bring these large language models to consumers, and they just like absolutely blew up and had very concrete consequences, right? Like anytime these consumer facing products blow up, all of a sudden there's money flying around and everyone wants to get in on the action.
Oh, yeah. Right. And it's an OpenAI and DeepMind. They both started with the idea of helping kind of rein in the progression of AGI and make it safe. And but when there's a lot of money involved, I guess it's like, screw it, look at the money. So that's interesting because, you know, it ties back to, you know, content and stuff too. And I think as I'm writing my new book right now, I mean, I've been harnessing AI. I mean, I was doing this last night. I pay for all three. I use them as my development editors right now. So I'll like have it go through the flow of one, you know, I'll edit it, hand that off to the next one, you know, give me some feedback on this. And I think between the three, it actually works really well in the sense with writing where it definitely provides perspectives that, you know, that you or I wouldn't have, right? So I think the danger with you and me when writing Fundamentals of Data Engineering was we knew each other too well. We were, you know, best friends. And so it was like very, if one of us missed something, the other probably missed it too.
Very much. Yeah. That was always a danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's interesting. I want to relate this to something. Terence Tao, very famous mathematician, but he had a post, which maybe it was on Mastodon. I think it was on Mastodon a couple days ago.
Well, that's still around.
Apparently. So I'll try to find it. We'll put it in the show notes. But he was talking about in mathematics how, well, he was actually talking about security. So he's a mathematician, but he was talking about IT security. And in IT security, you have a blue team and a red team. And the blue team's job is to build out secure systems, right? Okay, we're going to have these security practices. Here are security standards. The red team's job is to break the security of the blue team, right? So find how they screwed up. And that's often by analyzing systems, but it's also by actively attacking systems. Obviously not trying to actually bring them down, but saying, oh, we were able to get in through this backdoor that you left. We need to fix this.
Right.
And he was talking about LLMs. He said, you know, in mathematics and other areas, I kind of see AI as more appropriate to be the red team side of things, which is very much what you're talking about, right? Like not writing for you, which generates just not great writing from my perspective.
Yeah.
But saying, hey, you know, this is what you're missing that I see that your style could be better in this area, or you missed this idea over here, or have you thought about this author? Obviously, I have to check if it's hallucinated or not.
But. Sure. But I mean, I find it's a very good development editor. I mean, it's on par with the editor that we had, who I think was the best one under our old publisher.
Yeah.
In the sense where it understands. And now the problem is it doesn't, you know, if you feed it a chapter, it doesn't understand the context of previous chapters. Right. So you have to sort of, you know, give it the docs. But I've been finding it very good just to pinpoint, okay, does this thing flow? Like I was doing that last night, right? And so I think that helps speed up the process for sure, at least for editing and so forth. Like what, you know, even for copy editing, I came up with some really good suggestions. Like, you know, Grammarly does this too, but I feel like, you know, the other LLMs find things that Grammarly somehow doesn't. But nowadays though, right? I mean, you bring this up, it's sort of, you're using it to red team, but you don't want to red team yourself towards mediocrity either.
Exactly. And you don't want to regress to the mean, to borrow the statistical idea, right? You don't want to push everything toward what everyone else is doing. You want uniqueness. You want your own voice. You want your own style. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's kind of my problem with Grammarly going back. It behaves more like a blue team tool where it intervenes too much in your writing as opposed to saying, this is something you could think about saying, you need to change this, even though you're like, no, that makes it way too bland. You know,
makes it too bland. Yeah. It's like the legal team in a big company or the PR team.
Right. Just like everything.
Can't say
you
that.
You ruin everything.
You ruin everything. So.
Yeah. But let's talk about this with respect to data engineering. I mean, I get very nervous when I see young data engineers ask ChatGPT or Claude or whatever, how do I do X? And then they get some response back and they'll ask me about it. Like, oh, ChatGPT told me this. And I'm like, that doesn't sound quite right. But on the other hand, if we treat it more as a systems analysis tool to say, okay, here's my code. What security holes or privacy holes or other types of problems might be in this code that I haven't identified? Then it starts to be a bit more interesting, I think.
But you got to know what you're looking for, right? So this is what I've been telling, you know, the audiences I've been giving, you know, talks to and in classes, right? So I lecture at a lot of universities and give advice, good or bad, to students. And one of it is obviously, you know, pick up the fundamentals, you know, of data engineering or whatever your practice is, right? Understand the baseline, understand, you know, the mental frameworks for your discipline. And then use these tools, really. And the other thing I tell people, though, is go all in on AI. Like, but learn to use these tools responsibly. You know, on the flip side, on the extreme right now, you know, Anthropic recently announced rate limiting on Claude Code and so forth. And, you know, but I have friends who are just running Claude Code nonstop. I'm sure these rate limits are targeted at these people. you know, these are very senior engineers and they're just like, screw it, I'll just have agents just write code nonstop. I have mixed feelings on this, of course, and I'd love to know your opinion, but I think that's the other extreme where people know so much, but then they're letting these tools do everything. But then how do you know if it's good or what it is or anything, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And in fact, I think Chip Hoyan had a post about this recently on LinkedIn, and she was talking about how, and she's an engineer I respect. In other words, I know that she's careful when she uses these tools, which not everyone is. And she was basically saying that at some point, you can only analyze so much code that it generates, right? Yep. So you can have it, but if you're careful, if you're a good engineer, then you're still going to be the bottleneck. And that's actually important, because if you're not the bottleneck, then it might be generating insecure code or any number of things because you're not checking anything, right? And that is terrifying. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was vibe coding an app. I talked about this a few weeks ago, but and I wrote about it on LinkedIn, but it was started suggesting open source packages that I looked more deeply. I'm like, why do you keep suggesting this? I've never heard of this before. Uh-huh. And so I look, and it's obviously tied to a paid service, right? So I'm like, okay, so this is also a vulnerability. So if you vibe code an app and you become too dependent on this dependency, well, guess what? You know, you may have to pay money that you didn't think you needed to pay or didn't want to, right? So there's a bunch of unintended consequences of this. So I the way I use it now is I build it from the ground up. I'm like, you know, either I write the code or I have, you know, just the next step. So at least I know what I'm building, because software typically was built bottom up, right? Well, there was never a situation where you had top down software unless you bought a low code tool or no code tool and it just given to you. But even those
are always questionable. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But now you have this at a scale, and I guess stochastically, you know, it's way more open ended in terms of what you can develop. But this is consequences for data engineering now, right? Because I always tie it back to, you know, how would we have done this book differently now?
Right.
I don't know that I would have actually changed much in this book. I think 90% of it, 95% of it still holds. Yeah. But there's that obviously the aspect of AI is the big one. So,
I mean, to me, it's more things that I would add, I'll tell you.
Mm, yeah.
So one of the big things, and David Talby from John Snow Analytics John Snow Labs is a huge advocate for this, but he's basically arguing that in their practice, analyzing medical records, they've shifted to relying substantially on classical NLP. Why do we call it classical? It's not that old. It's, you know, like a decade old, but because we have LLMs. But classical NLP is statistical analysis of language and tokenization and things that you do with Spark. And he's basically said, you know, first of all, LLMs hallucinate. And second, they're very, very expensive, which is why Claude Code is starting to be throttled, right? And so we use LLMs, but use classical NLP to do the heavy lifting and figure out how to funnel as much of your work as possible through the statistical tools, because it's so much cheaper and faster and any number of other things. And so that's one thing that I probably would have shifted. Well, I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe at some point that's another book or something, but it's like stuff that should be added here. I think at the time when we were writing the book, I felt like there was too much emphasis on NLP because data engineering really tended to focus on the shiny stuff, right? And NLP is definitely, at the time, was like this cool thing that everyone talked about, not that many people did. I feel like LLMs have driven actually the demand for that significantly more. And within the next couple of years, classical NLP will be one of the most in-demand skills to like refactor out of these very, very expensive LLM-based systems.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there's a really good report that came out kind of later last year, but it talked about exactly this. We may have talked about it on the podcast, actually, but it was Paco Nathan turned me on to it.
Yeah.
But it just looked at basically the viability of certain machine learning models, logistic regression versus deep learning versus using an LLM. And lo and behold, I think it's for epilepsy. Don't call me on that, but I think it was logistic regression actually was the simplest, cheapest, and I think pound for pound, the most effective, actually, given everything, weighing all things out, cost, everything. Yeah. And so, you know, you can do that in Excel.
Yeah. But the point is where data engineers come in is when the data gets to large enough scale that you need some heavy lifting with Spark or something like this, right? And so I think if I had it to do over again, or maybe that's, again, something I would add on, is like, we need more data engineers who can kind of cross over into data science and help the data scientists get out of pandas, get out of, you know, memory based single node tools into stuff that can scale. I mean, you make the point frequently that not everyone has big data, and that's fair. But I think once you get into a large web app with lots of log data, lots of user activity, millions of users, then you need data engineering, right? And that's where we're still seeing data scientists hit a wall, and they can use more crossover help from data engineering to accomplish things.
Now, what are you seeing though, right? So I think that's getting help from data engineers is one thing, but how it does make me wonder, you know, we talked about this in the book, actually, this notion of the convergence of roles, and you're actually seeing this now. you know, how could a data scientist just use AI? Do they need a data engineer to help
them?
That's
a good question. Yeah. Expand on that. I think that's a good point. It makes me nervous, again, because if you do it wrong, it can be very, very expensive in terms of reputational cost or security cost or any number of other things. But like, if I'm a data scientist, how do I do it right with AI without breaking something, basically?
Well, you see this happening. I mean, all the data engineering tools are basically, you know, becoming AI tools, quote unquote.
Right.
You know, even software engineering tools and so forth. So the lines of separation, I think, are becoming increasingly blurry, right? Of course, MLOps is still a thing. We should do that. In fact, I think it's going to be more important.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there's a tendency with all these tools to give you the impression that, you know, for better or for worse, that you do have these capabilities sort of, you know, left and right, you know, of where you are. So it should be, yeah, I think that the temptation will be there. The capabilities will be there. Whether that's a good idea or not, I don't know. Because I think the supposition right now is, well, maybe we don't need to hire anybody else because AI can just sort of fill in the gaps.
Yeah.
Right? What? But somebody said that data engineering is dead because, you know, AI will do everything. And I was like, yeah, but I think you're missing the entire point of like what data engineering is. It is the life cycle we described. It's the undercurrents, security, orchestration, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't go away, right? Yeah. So you still need to understand that and manage it. AI just accelerates it for better or worse, actually.
It really can accelerate it for worse if you're not careful, right? Like you can do all kinds of insecure things. There are all kinds of very unethical things quickly if you're not careful. But if you use it right, yeah, I agree, it's a powerful tool. What is the role of expertise from your perspective in a world where we have all these AI tools? And of course, this is very relevant to data engineering because it's intended to be a domain of expertise. So yeah, do we care about expertise now if we have all these tools?
It's an interesting question. And it's actually the next book I'm working on.
Oh, nice.
After this one. Yeah.
Tell me more. I mean, obviously don't spill the tea, but you know what?
Well, I mean, it's sort of one of the central questions, I think, of today's age is, you know, why invest in education at all? Why have books?
Right.
Why take the time to do anything when AI can, at least in theory, do stuff or manifest stuff for you or conjure it for you? And conjuring is a very good term for that. And so it is something I've been struggling with. I don't think I have an answer. I don't think anybody actually has an answer right now.
Yeah.
Because every time you say the role of expertise is necessary, well, the economy would sort of tell you otherwise in that sense, where hiring is, you know, at least in the tech sector, it's slowing down. You know, if you needed more experts, for example, then the proof would be that you're hiring more experts, right? But it's an interesting time right now because if you listen to quote experts in the field, especially executives, this is where I'm having a bit of cognitive dissonance. Is, you know, we're being told, well, AI is going to help us, but at the same time, you're hearing CEOs say, well, screw it, we don't need to have anybody doing soul crushing jobs anymore, so we'll just have AI do everything. You know, and so I actually know people that work at a lot of these, you know, big companies, and they're saying, yeah, the AI capabilities are not quite there yet, not even close. But so it's an interesting time for expertise. I would say that, you know, if you know, I was reading the other day in Wall Street Journal about how, you know, the number of people going after economics PhDs has collapsed.
Yeah, I saw that
article.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's happening across the board, I think, in a lot of degrees right now. And, you know, it is an interesting time. I don't have an answer. This is why I'm trying to write a book, I think, to at least help myself understand what we're going through right now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's interesting. What do you think? What do you think about expertise?
So on the one hand, I feel like just say in the domain of mathematics, I don't really do mathematics per se anymore, but that's what I got my PhD in. And, you know, some of the tedious work, I assume, will be removed by AI. You'll be able to investigate literature more quickly, get hopefully accurate summaries of theorems and results. And yet, I feel like there's a level of creativity and insight that you're just never going to get if you hand off things to a machine to do them for you, right? So one thing I'll compare it to is if you read a book in translation versus reading in the original language. Translations are very valuable. It's very valuable to have literature from all over the world delivered to you in English. But there are things that you will never quite get if you don't read it in the original language. And I think it's something similar. When you ask AIs to summarize things, there are details that you'll never quite understand without like going through the years of tedium to really like grind and get deeply into the subject and do, you know, numerous just basic tedious exercises and read papers again and again and work on problems for just hours and hours and hours, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I don't think we would have come up with the content for a book, you know, if we were just, you know, two noobs out of university. Like, how would you do that? How would you have the experience, you know, or the insights, for better or for worse, to write a book like this, right? And I think it's, you know, I'm looking at a bunch of books here right now. I'm looking at, you know, Artificial Intelligence by Stuart Russell and Peter Norvig, two OGs. I'm looking at Bill Inman's book. I'm looking at Ralph Kimball's book, and all those people, you know, I can't speak for Ralph, although I heard he's, you know, had a lot of experience. Bill, I know he's a very close friend now, and it's, you know, he wrote that book because he, this is a problem that was, you know, nagging at him for probably 10 years, right?
Yeah.
And so one reason I actually started a publishing company was because I feel like more than ever right now, you know, the books that are going to change the face of the industry, change the thinking of the industry, these are still going to be needed. And I think people are actually going to want this more and more, you know, especially in the face of a bunch of AI slop. So, so I think expertise matters, but it's also, you know, the reality is right now, junior jobs in the tech industry are being gutted out. So like, how do you develop expertise when you can't get a damn job?
That's just it. And it does feel like, and this is starting to leak out from different people working in places like Microsoft, there's some pushback on what's going on. And there are, it looks like the industry is kind of committing a big self-own, right? Like basically doing things that are expedient now that look really good to shareholders right now, but that are going to harm them in the future. So one of those you mentioned is the fact that we're not training a new generation of engineers, which used to be such an emphasis of Silicon Valley, right? You would hire as much talent as possible, even though that talent couldn't contribute from day one, because you knew that in like 5 years, they were going to be really valuable. And we're not doing that now. Another cell phone. I saw an article where basically they had interviewed some Microsoft engineers working on .NET. I think it was like anonymous because they were speaking about the internals of the company. They were basically saying that AI was generating all these pull requests for .NET, like one of Microsoft's major libraries for Windows. And a lot of them were just terrible. And so, yeah, in theory, all this code was being generated by AI, but they were having to go through all this gunk and reject all these pull requests, or their managers would tell them that they had to accept a lot of the pull requests. So either you spend a lot of time filtering bad code and rejecting it, or you accept the bad code and you make do permanent damage to your library, right? Because it's very hard to undo API changes once they happen. Like, you have to support them going forward.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is interesting. Like, you know, but kind of taking a step back, like, I think, you know, writing this book, it changed our lives. You know, I think
it really
you know, it did. So I'm proud of what we built. So, you know, it's awesome.
Yeah. So. And I would say, I mean, it is a hard time to get into the industry right now, but I think there's just still a lot of value in old school tedium, like learning things the old fashioned way, even if you get some assistance from tools, and writing the old fashioned way, which I think is what you're doing now, basically, right?
Oh, yeah, so, I mean, I'm using AI to help. But it's interesting, you know, I mean, I think people, there's still an interest in this, though, right? I mean, there's not a day that goes by our book isn't posted on some social media as being recommended. You know, it's still in like the top, you know, between 10 and 20,000 or sometimes less on Amazon, still 3 years in.
Yeah.
So it does resonate with people, right? Like, but I think the cool thing that I'm proud of is that at that point, you know, a book doesn't carry itself on marketing at all. It's either a good book or it's not. So, you know, so that's, so thanks for writing a good book.
Thank you.
It was a lot of fun.
And I feel like, and you know, you've talked to Andrew Ng quite a bit about this. One of our big focuses is data quality, right? And data quality is one of those things that's notoriously hard to define, but good data engineers understand how to build quality data and how to continually improve the quality of data through essentially like these agile methodologies. And thus far in AI training, that has not come up at all. And I think it's going to. And that's kind of Andrew Ng's point too. It's like, you can talk about scaling laws, but what are you scaling toward? What performance are you actually scaling toward? Like, having higher quality data means you're scaling actually toward a more performant target. Whereas if it's just a bunch of stuff from whatever 8chan or, you know, who knows, what are you actually scaling toward if you ingest all this junk data? And that's where I think these data engineering principles are going to resonate as we actually start filtering some of the stuff that we're scraping in order to train models.
Exactly. Yeah.
So one of the things we saw again and again, and we kind of mentioned this earlier, is that companies would choose inappropriate storage systems for the type of data processing they needed to do, right? And so one of the most common is that they would take something like Snowflake and they would try to do like transactional streaming updates to it, which is, we'll bring Snowflake to its knees. And so Snowflake and any of these columnar databases can be like very efficient, very fast. But if you try to do transactional updates to them, that it will really cause problems and cost a huge amount of money. And basically, you'll often hear people talk about X system is really fast or X system is really performant. And you always have to ask the question, like, what does it mean to be performant in this context? What are you actually trying to accomplish? So are you trying to serve transactional updates from a million users and maybe serve 100,000 updates per second? Or are you trying to analyze 10 petabytes of data in a time efficient manner? Those are very, very different problems. And if you choose the wrong system to do the type of problem you're trying to solve, then it will be very slow. If you choose the right system, then it will be very fast. And I think that's one of the points we tried to make in the book. There's a whole chapter on choosing technologies, basically. And that's because in the trenches, we saw again and again that people always went to stuff they were familiar with rather than an appropriate tool to solve the problem at hand.
Yeah, I think that happened a lot. I mean, it certainly kept us busy.
Yeah. It's kind of the nature of consulting that you get called in to do the same thing over and over again, right? And you don't recognize it at first. And then you're like, oh, I saw this problem before. And that's why you write a book, right? You can write about some of these high level problems.
So well, it reminds me of my plumber, right? What he talked to plumbers, and people do the same stuff over and over. Thanksgiving, for example, right? Stuff an entire turkey down the garbage disposal. You know you shouldn't do that, but this happens every year.
Right. So, or, and, you know, turkey frying accidents, if you're medical personnel. How many of those do you see every year?
You have a staff already on call right? It just happens. But yeah, I think it's the same sort of thing. It's a curse of familiarity. It's the curse of convenience as well. You know, and so this is just what it is. But, you know, but this, I guess, is the point of the book that we wrote, too, is it's important to separate what you want to do from the things that you should do. And sometimes these are not the same things.
Right. And this goes back to the expertise conversation, right? Because one problem, I think, with ChatGPT is it's very creative. And so you'll ask questions, you'll get different answers every time. Whereas some things have a pretty clear answer, right? If you've seen the same problem five times, then if you become an expert and you actually start getting bored with what you're doing, that's a good indication of expertise. Then you probably know the answer off the top of your head because you've seen it before several times and you've done this kind of work enough to know what the solution is.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, cool. Yeah. It's a happy 3 years on the book.
Yeah. It's gone quickly, hasn't it?
Feels like yesterday.
pretty wild. So, yeah.
Yeah. You going to write another book?
Right now I'm working on some course materials, basically.
Nice.
So, yeah. Cool. I know you developed a data engineering course. I have one I'm developing as well. So
sick.
Got some things going on in that department. And then, yeah, we'll see. What and when can we expect your book? I guess it's...
I split it into three parts, right?
That's right.
So the book is 600 pages or more. So I just said, fine. So sometime this fall, I think it'll drop. Assuming I can hit it right before holiday season gets a bit nuts. Otherwise, I might actually postpone it. But I'm hoping to get it done. So yeah. Plus, I'm on fall tour pretty soon, going all around the world. So it's like, kind of have to get it. Like, if you're going to get it done, get it done.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Get the process shut down, closed out, and get it delivered to the publisher. Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah, but I'm the publisher now, so I get to do all the fun stuff too, right? So it's a lot of work, but
Cool, man.
We'll have to catch up sometime, but yeah, it's good to see you.
Yeah, glad we could do this. Thank you for the invitation.
Of course.
Yes.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.